Welcome to Act 3, the podcast where we explore how to thoughtfully shape the rest of our lives. I'm your host, Kara Gray. This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching service where I help executives and professionals plan their Act 3. For more information, stay tuned until the end.
Today, I welcome Kevin Newby to the podcast. Kevin has always thrived on thinking outside the box, working creatively and solving problems across various media types and business categories. From healthcare to gaming, consumer packaged goods to spirits, and finance to consumer electronics, he's done it all. Kevin's expertise in internet commerce, digital and social media marketing, brand management and integration, and data analytics has led him to his current passion, which is executive life coaching. That path makes sense. It does. And we're going to get into it.
That is how the journeys take us.
That's right. So full disclosure, Kevin and I used to work together in a much different space at a global advertising agency called Havas. And we recently reconnected on LinkedIn and both realized we're in the coaching industry. So here we are. I think this is going to be a fun interview. Welcome to the podcast, Kevin.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So I always like to rewind with these interviews before we get to what's happening today in your third act, as I'm going to define it. Can you share your experience transitioning from traditional advertising to the digital landscape during your early career in Silicon Valley?
You know, of the transitions, that probably was the easiest because I was the youngest and least life experienced, and I was just kind of coming into my own as a creative person. So I was just absorbing things. I've always been interested in computers. I mean, my folks plopped a Mac Classic on our desk at the home office back in the day. And I've noodled around with that. And so just technology was always an interest for me as a medium to express creativity. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't a particularly strong illustrator or painter, but the computer gave me some flexibility in that. So when I was in a traditional space and had learned all those traditional tools in college and so forth, you know, you're already working on desktop publishing. Hey, what's this other app to use? Here's another way to express yourself. And here's another creative need. And I was a hustler. So I wanted to learn. I wanted to be valuable in the organization and do something more. So that's kind of how I got into the digital space, because it happened and I was sort of in the right place, right time. And I just took that, surfed that wave as far as I could take it.
Right. And you were part of several digital startups and acquisitions in the 90s. What were the biggest challenges or learnings from these experiences?
Well, depending on where you are in that acquisition process, you realize how little control you have. You know, you really, you know, for all the, I was important in my organization at this level, but now this is a different organization. So you sort of had to find, you had to discover, you sort of had to, I guess, prove yourself again, or prove yourself to new people, or community, you know, express yourself in a way that showed you were worth keeping around. You know, those first acquisitions, you don't realize that everybody's kind of on a 90-day plan. You don't see that coming, especially with your really young person. And we were also, you know, being, you know, this was, you know, pre-30, so I was in my 20s, and
yeah.
Those first acquisitions, it was like, oh, it's always going to be like this. And, you know, the go-go 90s and the dot-com boom and living in Silicon Valley and working in San Francisco, I mean, it was, you know, being that young and having such little experience, you thought, oh, is this how it goes? Oh, this is how it is. Okay, great. You know, you just kind of thought that way. So that there was sort of a, obviously, it's a beautiful naivete, right? It's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great because you're just, and then you work your tail off and you have a great time and you're trying to learn and grow in that space. But the challenges might be, if you're to get back to your question, answer your question, I think it was, you know, the lack of control you really realize as your company changes. You know, I was a third person in an organization and all of a sudden we went to like maybe 20 people, and then we were acquired and merged and now we're 40 people. And then all of a sudden, in a few years from that point, they're like, well, we're going to spin everybody who plays in the zeros and ones business and a whole nother company. So all these people that I was working with are now no longer, oh, I don't get to work with my print producers and I don't get to work with my, you know, account people. Now I'm working again with project managers. So like, you don't, really noticed the lack of control you have. And I think I didn't recognize that at the time because I was just loud and obnoxious and in the mix of everything. You know, I was just like, what are you doing? Let me get in on that. So that was sort of, you know, I was already making a name for myself during those times. So perhaps I didn't see that, but I did, you know, we lost people and you're like, ooh, yeah. You know, that kind of stuff. So those are the tough things in transition. And also the change in corporate philosophy and strategies, you know, cultures change, you know, policies change. Just having new HR procedures are actually as powerfully, culturally, fundamentally changing when, on one hand, you're kind of making up HR, which is embarrassing because there's that part of it. You know, where's HR? I'm HR today. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you go to, wow, we have a professional organization. So learning what professionalism is was very interesting. And, you know, so, and some people struggled with that because they wanted to have that. I don't want to, you know, do what this new organization says. So some people selected themselves out and some people were selected out. But watching that was probably pretty difficult.
Yeah. If nothing else, we learned flexibility.
Well, I was pivoting from the third meeting.
That's right. So you founded Cadium in 2001, and that was a significant move, especially during a challenging market period. How did you manage to grow that company successfully?
Well, I think a lot of that was simply due to a belief in ourselves. You know, I often say we were lucky and good. I mean, I had two great creative partners who... that we were all aligned in what we wanted to do. I had a core vision of what I thought the value proposition of what our company was. You know, I'm sure a lot of people saw the writing on the wall, but I just noticed that the modem wasn't going to be the future. You know, broadband was going to happen. I was seeing new technologies come out to make video happen and new tools available and new creative ideas and more creative people sort of pointing at the space as a medium to explore marketing creativity or just general creativity. I mean, the internet has always been a creative space, but in those early days of marketing, it was really like a direct marketing, a direct response medium. And I wasn't a direct response lover per se. I just wanted to make creative things and do bigger things. And at the time, we were sort of relegated as the redheaded stepchildren, no offense to redheaded stepchildren and all the podcasts, but like, you know, we were at the table like, oh, you're just the internet people, but we knew what was going on. So we had that belief in that. We had a belief in our partners and we were young and just hustled hard. You know, we also got lucky. So one of my partners, I mean, both partners were business hungry, right? They kind of knew how to sell their art because they were creative directors. They understood how to sell themselves and present ideas. And we just used the three of us who were all creative directors kind of said, well, we know how to sell our work, we could probably sell our agency, you know, sell ourselves.
Yes.
And then there's that aspect. And then we got lucky because we got an opportunity to pitch a project with Genentech, which is now a Roche company, right? A major pharma brand in Silicon Valley or the South San Francisco. I was savvy enough to knock on doors of traditional agencies. I didn't pay rent for the first 2 years of the company because I bartered time, you know, just three guys in a little office, you know, who bartered, and we bartered space with time, and the agency didn't know what to do with this. And one day the account exec from Electronic Arts knocked on our door and said, do you guys know how to do buy media and can you make banners? And we were like, have you seen our portfolio? What are you talking? And so overnight we went from, we've got like 800 grand in media we want to spend in Q4. And then it turned into a $4 million media budget in like, you know, a few months. So because EA is like, it seems the kids are on the internet who game, you know, and here, and
we those were, kids, they buy stuff.
Those kids, they're so progressive. So we were sort of in that space. So lucky and good. And I hope I answered the question, but that's kind of.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that leads us to where I met you when Cadium was acquired by Havas. Sure. And you moved to Chicago, which had to be a big change. How did your role as director of strategy like differ from your previous positions? Like what did that turn into? Because that was, I mean, a massive cultural change. I knew from being inside of us, and I can only imagine us.
You know, I mean, I think
what that felt like.
So like I started talking about like when you're a certain space in an organization, you don't realize, you know, you're not that close to the sun. And now I have the wax wings and I'm right there like, holy cow, this is what's happening. I mean, I had powerhouse lawyers, global heavy hitters that were like wooing me, but also screwing me, you know, like they were doing both. Right. And I don't want to say I'm a naive guy, but I'm an honest and trusting person. And so I just trusted no one was trying to do that. So I went in, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Not to say that didn't go that way. There were certain a few things that we got caught up in, but again, learning lessons, you know.
Yeah.
Done a merger acquisition before.
Oh, yeah.
First time for everything. So I think that transition was powerful because, talk about a system change. I mean, the one thing I think was I had pushed myself to my limits of just moxie, right? So I had never studied accounting, never studied business, I was a graphic design major. I was a design major at UC Davis, which is known for a design program. And I just started a company and worked in companies that way. And so when I was running Cadium, I was making it up and learning on the job, every department except for, creative. So my partners did all the creative work. They were the product and I was everything else. And I had realized that I had run out of, runway, like I needed help. And my partners, we all realized like, hey, we want to grow. How do we do this? So, that transition was then letting go, right? Like, we sold. So that means now I have a CEO, so I can take that hat off. And we have a CFO and I can take that hat off. And we have an account director. I can take that half off. I think the thing that was most difficult is that it put me into a place of, well, where do I fit in now? What do I do? And so finding and defining, my role was probably the most challenging part, because now I was untethered from running a company. And now I had to figure out what I could contribute to an organization and what I meant to me. Like, what did I enjoy in this now with these things that were kind of a burden, right? Like, being a CEO is quite burdensome. The old lonely at the top. I'm not saying, poor me, but it's everyone is coming at you, for your clients, to your partners, to your vendors, to everybody. And that's the job. And that's why, I didn't get paid 14,000x to my employees, but I can understand to some degree why CEOs get paid that much. Now all that was gone. Now I'm back, with a shovel, and I'm finding my way through finding a new trench. So that transition was good. I think when I look back on that time, I think my, not an error, but just a approach I had that I think was not as effective is I'm so collaborative, it got in my way. Like, this attitude of, is it okay for me to do it this way? Is this okay? And I didn't see the reflection of what the people that just hired me were like, no, we think you're kind of a big deal. So go forth and be a big deal. I was like, is this cool if I do it this way? And I was very much checking in and I was very timid about it, which despite how I started, which was totally untimid. And, I was such a punk. I used to meet with other agency studios and I go, hey man, I am so sorry. And they'd look at me, we're at the, some event, like, I'm so sorry that we have to crush you, And I didn't tell me, that was the kind of stuff I would say. And now I was very much like, holy, Havas, 75 countries, 14,000 offices, thing, like a massive, they're listed, they're number 7 in the list of big marcoms, like, holy cow.
Yeah, French owned, like, yeah, this whole other, like, European vibe happening there. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's wild.
So that was cool. So I just had to kind of reinvent myself and find that space for me. And I always do, because I think at the heart of who I am, I'm a creative person.
Yeah.
Ideas don't stop for me. I've never been short of ideas. So now I just translated my ideas into new places. And I really liked helping people. And Havas needed a lot of help. I mean,
yeah, for sure.
I remember rolling in and they were like, the account team was so excited about the website they did for Valspar, the beautiful, beautiful work, like print campaign and TV stuff. It was so incredible. It was like beautiful, really helped that brand. And they built a website and they're really proud of it, as they should have, because they had this beautiful idea and beautiful brand strategy. It was great. And then they're telling me, and we got, $100,000 for this site. I was like, that's a pretty good price for that site. And then I turned to the account I mean, the project manager and the design team and the engineering team, and they're like, yeah, but it only cost us 10x of what we brought in because we didn't know how to build a website. And I was like, oh, I can help. You know, I can help.
I'm here.
Okay. I got that. So, you know, I help, you know, I noticed those things. So just, and also I love, I think, you know, what will be a thread to where I am today is like, I enjoyed teaching and I enjoyed mentorship, and not that I was so high-minded that I was better than anyone, but I just was excited to share ways of working that were different. And I believed in a lot of possibilities. I had a creative director when we were early in Cadium. They'd bring us in on pitches because they didn't have any digital. So we would be the digital partner and just put on that agency's hat and go, yes, we're the agencies. So many cards in the pockets of creative people and agencies, as we all know.
Yeah.
And he said, no, this is a possibilities conversation, not feasibilities, you know? And I just love that statement because yes, we will get to the logistics and yes, we will always come to the reasons we can't do things. That's obviously going to get there, but why start there? And so that's kind of been something that I've always had in me to sort of start with. What's possible here? Can we do it?
Mm-hmm.
I never like when we say we can't. I never like it. I still struggle with that. But, you know, as I get more life experience, you know, some things you got to let go, you know, like you just, you know,
for sure.
As best you can. So,
yeah,
is the question.
Well, the thread is all starting to line up to where you are today. But I want to talk about something else that we actually haven't talked about yet, and I'm sure has influenced the work that you're doing now as well. After you left Chicago for opportunities back in California, you were diagnosed with throat cancer.
Yes.
And I remember seeing that news on Facebook and just feeling so much and being like, oh, like, I can't believe it. This is just awful. I couldn't even imagine what that felt like for you. Not to go dark, but can you discuss the impact of your cancer diagnosis on your career and personal life and how it influenced your decision to do what you're doing now in terms of executive life coaching? Because I'm positive that it's all connected.
And we'll pull the thread.
Yeah.
Let me see. Like, so, you know, I got back and I was, again, kind of untethered. You know, I was pretty exhausted coming out of Chicago. You know, I had two kids. My spouse and I were looking at each other like, are we going to be living in Chicago forever? Is this a time to move? You know, just there was this thing about whether or not, you know, Havas was it was a wonderful experience because it was both, like I say, it was awesome. It was awesome like chocolate cake on days. And on some days it was a tsunami, like, oh my God, I can't take this. So, you know, there was a lot of, and I had been pushing so hard. I mean, I'd been working almost 20 years, almost near 20 years at that point. And I was just going. And I'd also just added kids and added a relationship, you know, a marriage, and I'd added houses and I had added moves and I'd added all this stuff. And so I was like, felt like I was pulling the world behind me. I also didn't know how to express myself in a certain manner. I think there's some of us, my partner thinks, you know, that the blue throat chakra, and I mean, blue is my favorite color, but, you know, the throat chakra sort of says, hey, you got to express yourself. And I didn't know how to express myself very well. So there's some, you know, some folks that said, hey, maybe there's something about that. And I took it all in. But
yeah,
what was tough about it is I was coming back, I was somewhat untethered again. I joined a PR firm. Because at the time, social media was just being handed to PR firms and they didn't know what to do with technology, digital strategy, content production, anything like that. So I joined a firm, you know, their values, strategy, and creativity didn't align with mine. So I didn't last very long. But during that time is when I found, hey, what's this lump on my throat? And being that, I think the thing it taught me is like, I wasn't thinking about myself ever. I was so outside of myself. So I got this lump in my throat in like October of, I guess it was like 13. And I just thought it was a swollen gland from having the flu. And then I went through Q1 and I'm like in February and I go, hey, honey, I got this lump on my throat. And she's like, well, how long have you had it? Oh, since October. And I mean, God bless women, you know, like, I don't know. It's something that about every woman I know is actually a little more somatically inclined. I mean, they're aware of their bodies. They pay attention to stuff. They take rest when they need it. They eat when they're hungry. Like, I didn't do any of that stuff. I was just a shark without eating. I was just going. And so that sort of forced me to stop. And what happened to me mostly was the panic as of my, again, outside of self. Oh my God, will my family be okay?
Yeah.
The time I changed jobs, I was unhappy with that firm. I joined a small agency called Cutwater. And I was working with them, and I wasn't there very long before I realized I had this issue. And that organization was wonderful. And to some degree, they shouldn't have made the decision they did around like what they agreed to. They said, we'll pay your, I was like, I just worried I won't be able to pay my bills. My parents, my kids will suffer. Well, that's what insurance is for when but they said, oh, we'll pay your whole salary. And I was like, oh, that's so sweet.
Oh my God. Wow.
It was incredible, right? They're incredibly generous. And so then I was just sort of stuck there, like having shit happen to me, but not really being aware of it. I think things I learned through the cancer process was, cancer is a specialization often at times, in my experience.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their own version of the hammer, and I am the nail. So everybody's like, oh, you need surgery. Oh, you need radiation. Oh, you need chemo. Oh, you need holistics. Oh, you need herbs. Oh, you need spices. You know, whatever it is, they're just literally everyone's coming at you with their specialty. And I realized no one had any holistic look at me except me. And it's sort of the first time of an awareness of like, oh man, I gotta kind of be engaged in this. Because I really didn't value my life that much. I figured, okay, well, if I croak, I got enough health insurance, the kids will be cool. Like, I didn't really value myself in the whole mix. I mean, it's a crazy thing to hear come out of someone's mouth, but I didn't go into panic mode about, oh, I'm going to die. I was like, well, if I'm dead, is everyone else going to be cool? That's how disconnected from myself I was. And also, I had a lot of, to call it survivor's guilt would be, an overstatement, but I will admit that throat cancer isn't the same as walking to Stanford Hospital and seeing people in the painter's mask with no hair who are being gurneyed in. And I'm waltzing in and out in my day clothes like a country club. Like, I could go play golf right after this.
Yeah.
You know, I was very blessed that the cancer I had at the end of the day with number of surgeries, you know, my doc looked at me and said, you're strong enough, you're young enough, why don't we hack you up a little bit? You know, we can pull all this stuff out of you. And I said, yeah, that sounds good. He's like, chemo and radiation. Radiation's a thing you can't have lots of times. So let's save that because, sorry, buddy, you've got cancer now. You may come back, so you got to be aware there's a future. You have a future. Let's make sure this is available to you. So it's like, okay. And at the end of the day, they couldn't find like a primary tumor. So I didn't know what that meant. And they kept poking and prodding me and looking around. I mean, I drank all the nuclear milkshakes and I was in all the machines that sound like an Nine Inch Nails songs. And I was like, yeah, great. And you come out and I realized they're like, I think they didn't want to admit it. Like, we think that maybe your body did it. And I was like, really? Me? Like, I did this. I stopped it. And they're like, we think so. Cause we can't find it. We pulled all this stuff out. And the thing we thought was this big is actually this big. And I was like, okay. So, okay. And then it kind of started me on a sort of a self-reflection. I was always very internalized and very thoughtful and very overthinky. And this was a different gear of overthinky, like, okay, where does this all mean now? Where do I fit in? How do I navigate this new life? I mean, I'm unfortunately immediately coming back because I was out of work and because they had given me my whole salary when I asked for vacation, they're like, oh, by the way, we're eliminating your position. So then I was unemployed. So that kind of coming out of cancer, I was reduction enforced. So I was forced to sort of figure out something right after that coming out of the cancer thing. And unfortunately that triggered me right back into old habits of, I got to take care of this whole family because I was the primary breadwinner of our home. And I'm living in Northern California and it's not a cheap town. So there's a lot of, I kind of let all that stuff I learned through cancer sort of put that to the side and go right back into, got to start grinding. So, that's kind of where my cancer journey is something I'm still sort of processing to a degree. I mean, it's an unfortunate club to be part of, and it doesn't matter that my cancer was my version. I'm still part of that club.
And, yeah.
I don't oversell it that much because my experience was as I shared, it is something that I've come to realize that I'm proud of how I handled it. I'm proud of what my body has done. I'm very more knowledgeable about the healthcare space. And when I can, I impart that kind of, you know, everyone's got a hammer. You got to advocate for yourself. And I think what I've noticed is I have had a few friends go through their cancer experiences. It's easy to defer, you know, to your doctor.
Yeah. You know,
defer that to it. And I think for me, maybe the big learning was like, be your own advocate. And that was probably the first piece of like, I got to stand up for myself more, because mm-hmm. I was such that collaborative part of the team guy, you know, take it on the chin for the team. I realized, well, I'm the only team I've got. So now I've got to kind of be more, more powerful about how I stand up in the world and for myself. And I think that was a big takeaway for me, but still figuring out where that fits in.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I think, like, you know, so many people go through a situation like that, and I appreciate you sharing your story. So what drew you to the Mankind Project and Vistage International? And how did these organizations shape your path to now becoming a certified coach?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was something about from 08 is when I sold KDM, or we sold the company, and transitions happened. And while that's a positive thing in many ways, it's still a traumatic thing. So from 08 to basically 18, I had significant, like, a life experience every year that many people would say one's enough, but I did 10 years of something intense. And I, again, that kind of drive that I had, which, you know, I learned was somewhat unhealthy, you know, in hindsight, right? In hindsight,
yeah, well,
could have taken a few more days off. I'm just saying, I could have taken a couple more days off. You know, I worked tremendously hard, and I had a lot of, like, what wasn't shared was coming out of cancer, then I get a reduction in force, then I have to find a job. So I start freelancing, mm-hmm. and within like the week of getting this freelance opportunity, which of course, if anyone's ever freelance, every hour you work is every dollar you make. So what do you think you're going to do, Kevin? You're going to work a lot of hours.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how to get the dough to pay for the stuff we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And then I had a house fire.
Oh,
so the house lit on fire, and that pressure within working freelance and all that stuff, it just put so much pressure that it put too much pressure on my relationship. And ultimately a lot of stuff came out during that time where my marriage failed. So then at the tail end of that, and when the marriage failed, and I'd found myself in this place thinking, wait a minute, I've worked my whole life for this group. You know, my family, my kids, my wife, I wanted to make sure that these people were covered. And at the end of the day, the result for me in my path was, you're not going to be married anymore. And that was like when I took a knee to the universe. I was like, okay, you know, new strategy, you know, I need to be young grasshopper. So obviously you can't unscramble the egg, but I did a lot of therapy, which was cool. You know, learned a lot, like how I operate, why I operate, what is it that caused that? And which is, I recommend therapy to everybody. It's so wonderful.
Absolutely.
The sales pitch for my therapist was, therapy is like surgery without anesthesia. And I was like, sign me up. You know, I was like, okay, great.
Kind of an accurate description.
Let me hold this scalpel. Let's get this out. So that was really good. And in that process, my sister, who's was engaged, her husband had participated in an organization called the Mankind Project. And she's like, you know, Kevin, this might be something to check out. So that organization was something that, again, took the knee. I was separated. I moved out of my home, which was so heartbreaking for me. I was alone up in Northern California. I had to get a new job because the job at my last agency finished. And so I had to transition from agency life to now I'm going to work client side in a category that I thought I knew, which was wine. I knew nothing, which was great. You know, I'm a beer and bourbon man. And they're like, what?
You mean, this is different.
Yeah, this is great. You know, like, I remember I getting asked questions about it and on the interview, and she's like, don't Google the answer. I'm like, no, I'm, you know, but sorry, I'm kind of rambling. So anyway, the point
was great.
I'm up in Northern California, and I find their group of men up there in Sonoma, and I show up on a rainy night in Petaluma, and it was just a very powerful experience to be in a group of men who had no skin in the game for who, you know, no judgments of me, but just wanted to hear the story. And I didn't say anything for a while. But what I realized is in that environment, I had a lot of men just sharing stories about their life. And what it opened me up to is that we all, at least what I've come to realize, is that the men have a lot of similar challenges, family, life, love, work, all the things. But since we don't have a community or a network to talk about it, you sort of think you're on your own. It was very lonely.
Yeah.
Energy. And what was nice is that, oh, you've had that problem too. You know, I just felt less alone in all the stuff that was struggle. So that was the first thing. It was sort of like, I'm not the only person to go through this, which was very empowering for me. You know, it really was like, it just took this weight off my shoulder. It didn't change the fact that I had to take care of the business of my life and that these things were happening to me and they weren't necessarily pleasant, but they did remind me that I'm not alone in all this. And if I needed to, I could pick up the phone and call one of these guys and just riff a little bit without judgment. And the idea of a judgment conversation, or the idea about someone truly just listening to you with no attachment to the outcome, was a totally freeing experience. Now, granted, I did therapy and that's similar, but this was different. There's no money involved. It was just men getting together, talking about life. And if you're willing to share, which I think we've kind of learned for this podcast, I'm not afraid to talk about myself. You know, I let it all out. I'm like, get this shit out, you know, better out than. So that's where the mankind hit me. And then I was working at a winery, at Gloria Ferrer Sparkling Wine House in Sonoma, and then COVID hit. So no reduction in force. You know, we got them in this great spot and they're like, great. We don't need directors of marketing anymore.
Okay.
So like many people on the street, and I had in my days, Acadium had worked with executive coaches, and I'd worked with an organization called Vistage International. One of my sort of mentors was from Vistage, and I found it a really empowering experience in a different way. It had elements of what mankind has, but it was professional, and I liked that a lot. And I thought about my own struggles as finding that work-life balance, or for me now, it's about equilibrium, you know, like divers, you just got to find that nice spot. And Vistage was this interesting thing where you bring together really powerful folks, you know, CEOs from different categories and different businesses who think they're alone, you know, similar to what I just described to mankind, think that no one knows what they're dealing with. And they get them in a room and say, hey, do you got a business problem you want to talk about? And then they present it and it was like, oh yeah, I've had that kind of problem. I've had a problem with this, or I've solved it this way. And it was this beautiful idea of facilitation. But in addition to that, what I think was most powerful is that in these work environments, the emotions and the feelings that these people were dealing with would also leak out. Like, I don't know why I'm so distracted. You know, I'm having a hard time getting focused at work and I can't get this thing done. I'm like, what's going on in your life? Oh, well, I've got to move my elderly parents into a home. Whoa, that's a big deal. And people go, yeah, I've done that too. And I went to this organization and these are the things I struggled with. So it was just a similar environments. And I was like, okay, there's something to this facilitation. There's something with helping people, like listening to people and letting people get it out. Mm-hmm. And then being sort of a shepherd of the conversation so that they don't get stuck in ruts. And I was like, I've been doing creative facilitation for so long, and brainstorms and ideation and stuff like that. So that's where Vistage took me. And it was difficult. I was unsuccessful in launching what they call a peer advisory group. You know, who wants to subscribe to a $30,000 a year subscription coming on the heels of COVID? And most CEOs don't think they need any help.
Which that's right.
comes with the territory. You know,
it does.
But I wasn't, I didn't take that the hard way. So that's where I got there. And then I got another opportunity in the wine business and did that for a while. And once again, bad market, reduction in force. I'm like, is the universe telling me something? Like, I can't seem to, this podcast is good. This guy can't hang on to a job. He must stink. No,
I'm not that bad.
And all that time, that seed of coaching was planted. And I actually explored this current iteration of coaching for me back at the beginning of COVID, and I chose Vistage instead of. And the reasons I chose Vistage was it felt like more organization, more team, more group. And I do feel that I do well in that setting. I've did this thing, life planning or something. I'll have to look it up and share with you later.
But, yeah.
You know, I'm a very much, it's, I do great with teams and do great with groups of people. And, but I realized I wasn't going to find that type of dynamic in maybe a W-2 job anymore.
Yeah.
Same time, I had all this life experience, all this professional experience. I'm like, what can I do with that? And, you know, coaching came to me as a way to take advantage of all this energy I've still got and all this experience and all these things and apply it in a way that could really transform people the way it transformed me.
Yeah.
And the scary part is, you know, I'm a bit of a man on an island now, right? It's a one man band. You know, this isn't Apple Partners. This is Kevin Newby at a standing desk. You know, you don't know what's going on down south. Swear it's professional. But, you know, like, you know, now I have to really go out there. And so where right now is that reinvention and that transition of this is something that I know, even if I go from standing to sitting desk, this brain will function, and I hope for a long time, and that I can, and I know that this thing will still pump the way it does, and that the, and I really want to help people get, you know, find the things they want in their lives. And that gets me going in the morning and gets me fired up about where I could go. Right now, it's just like, gotta get out there. So that's what I'm up to these days.
That's right. So I do an exercise with certain clients that's called the ideal end state, that I discovered kind of recently. And so I'm curious, without going into all the aspects, but I'm curious in particular, like, what is an ideal end state for your work? Who are the types of clients you want to work with? Like, who's ideal for you? Like, what kind of, you know, progress or what kind of transformation do you want to see in your clients? That kind of stuff.
You know, I think, selfishly, I want interesting people that are interested in growing, you know, or and curious people, right?
Yeah.
I like people that are curious. I like people that feel like there's more here, you know?
Yeah.
I feel stuck, but I don't know where I'm stuck, you know, that kind of energy. I do think, you know, where I've positioned myself as executive and I've added this life thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the brand of life coaching is kind of a bad rap, but that's because there's some bad eggs, you know, bad apples out there. And then there's not a lot of regulation in the coaching space. I know the coaching that I've done, so I'm completely comfortable with the fact that I know what can happen from this experience. So, you know, the ideal clients are executive types, people transitioning in companies, you know, going from like, if you were a doer, you know, you start a company and they're like, hey, you're great at this job. We want you to manage. I mean, that's a big change, you know, because you're so used to being the doer. How are you supposed to teach people what you do? A lot of people don't know how to do that.
Correct. So
that space, people that are, you know, like, oh my gosh, I want to get out of this career, change completely. Okay, let's work on that. You know, relationship stuff. I mean, I've been through that too. Child of divorce, and now I'm a divorcee myself. So
that's
very, very, very powerful and challenging space to be. How do you navigate that without collateral damage to family and kids, you know?
Yeah.
Those are spaces that I think I can help people sort of talk through. Men's issues, right? I think, as I said, I think there's a lot of emotion in men, but there's not a lot of portfolio for men to express it, you know? So oftentimes men just come across as angry all the time. Well, that's the one, that's the filter. So there's a lot of places to help navigate that and sort of validate all people's space and place. And just, again, my challenge is don't consult and detach. Like, I really want everyone to do well, but if you just don't want to do well, then we'll see you on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
So I hope that makes sense in terms of what I'm going for, but
it does.
Great.
It does. Sure. And also, where can people find you and find out about your coaching service?
Well, you know, I made it really hard. My brand is me.
That was smart.
And of course, I'm so old that I grew up when there's only .org and .net. Now there's .dot everything. So it's kevinnewby.coach is where you can find me.
Nice.
So I kept it simple. You know, I was like, I've done so much branding in my life. I don't want to brand this guy. I am my own brand at this point. So, you know, I just kept this. So kevinnewby.coach, it's, you know, you can email me. My initials, KMN at kevinnewby.coach. Very creative for
Chris. listen, it was time to simplify something. So, like, you know, I think that that's, you know, perhaps indicative of where you're headed here.
Yeah.
Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great interview, and I know my audience is going to enjoy it.
Thank you so much. It was really fun to catch up and asking me to tell my story. It's my story, and I love sharing it with people. And I hope that, you know, as I share these things, that people will feel less alone in that and more empowered and emboldened to, like, yeah, man, I'm curious. I want to figure some stuff out in my life. And using your services or my services or any coaching services.
Or your services first, and then you send them to me when they're ready to retire.
You could be a nice hand to you.
So I mean,
this is the thing. This is the
there's
thing.
There's space here. Thanks again, Kevin.
Pleasure's all mine. You take care.
This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching firm. I help executives and professionals plan the non-financial part of their retirement, like how to discover new purpose and how you want to spend your time. I offer a one-on-one coaching retirement blueprint package where we work together to discover some new avenues of exploration for your Act 3. This coaching is completely custom, and we'll provide you with a ton of resources and support as you transition to this new stage of life. For all the details, please go to goodmorningfreedom.com/services.